where we're landing this morning. We are going through the big story. Normally, we like to do a little bit of intro, but I got a lot of ground to cover, and so I'm going to skip much of an intro, and I'm going to encourage you, if you want to hear a really good intro and a really good reminder of what the big story is all about, get on the website and listen to Pastor Jordan's sermon from last week. It's called Outsiders Welcome. He just crushed that sermon, in my opinion. It was great. Go listen to the intro alone is worth the price of admission. So just listen to that, and it'll remind you of what we're doing here. And all right, 1 Samuel, here we go. We're starting to see a transition in this part of the big story of Israel going from being judged by judges to being ruled by a king. And this is also where they go from what is known as, I know you guys like really big words, so I looked up a couple of big ones for you. So they go from a theocracy to a monarchy. And a theocracy just simply means that they were ruled and governed by God himself. He was their king. He was the one that took care of them, or provided for them, and met their needs and protected them. He was the one that led them into battle. And they decided that they wanted to be a monarchy instead, and they wanted a man to rule them. They wanted to be able to look to a king and point to that man and say, you take care of us. And it's really a sad day in the history of this nation, because they had God himself as their king, and they didn't want it that way. It's a sad, you know, when you go and look at the kings, you'll find that not very many of them did it very well. Good kings were very rare. If they did do it right and honored God and followed him, things went out, you know, pretty well, but that didn't happen too much. So within the book of 1 Samuel, you're going to see three main characters. And I want to see how many, you know, if you guys are good Bible scholars, who do you think the first main character in the book of 1 Samuel is? Samuel, you guys are off to a great start. Yeah. And the second main character, Saul. Good job. And the third main character, David. Look at you guys go. I'm so proud of you. So if you've never read the book of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, it actually used to be one book, but because of scroll size limitations, they broke it into two books, but you'll see that they just flow right into one to the other. Really great Old Testament reading, full of just rich stories, and I would just encourage you to dig into those and read them. This book starts out with a man named Elkanah. He would take his family to the temple every year to worship God. Shiloh was where the temple was at this particular time, and he would go there once a year to worship God and to bring offerings. Elkanah had two wives, and this is a good time to mention again that just because you read something in the Bible doesn't mean that God was giving it a big thumbs up. Because if you remember in the garden, God created Adam and Eve, not Eve and Sue and Mary and Darla, and it was just two of them. And he said, I want these two to become one flesh. That's his clear design for marriage. That's the way it's always been. And so as we go through these stories, you're going to see people like King David and King Solomon have multiple wives and concubines. And because you read it doesn't mean that God was excited about that. In fact, that's not the way he wanted it. So Elkanah has two wives. One is named Peninnah and one is named Hannah. Peninnah can bear kids, and she can have lots of kids, it sounds like, very fertile. And Hannah can't have kids. And Peninnah is really mean about this. She treats Hannah poorly. So this is probably sounds similar to Sarah and Hagar that we read about like 18 years ago when we were in that section of the Bible. Feels like it's a while ago. It wasn't that long. So one year, basically, they go to the temple like they always do, and Hannah is just distraught. She's so broken that she can't have kids that she goes into the temple. She thinks she's by herself, and when she prays, she moves her lips, kind of like when I read. And so Eli's the priest at that time, and he sees her, and he thinks she's drunk because she's just in there moving her lips and talking, and he's like, what's, you know, I guess it was an odd thing to see somebody pray in the temple at that time, but that's what she was doing. And what she's praying for is that God would bring her a son. And she makes a vow to God that if you give me a son, Lord, I will dedicate him to your service all the days of his life. And she leaves, and they go back home, and sure enough, God answers her prayer. And she has a son, and she names him Samuel, which just means God heard. God listened. And she has other kids. She ends up with five other kids. But this one child, Samuel, she promised to the Lord. So that when they go back to the temple and he's old enough, she dedicates him to the temple. To Eli's the priest there, and he gets raised there. I'm in service to the Lord. So Eli basically raises him. She would come, you know, every year and bring him a little robe and, you know, make sure he was taken care of in that way. But this would be a hard thing to do, to let one of your kids go in this way. Similar to last week, we looked at Ruth. Samuel is just one of these exemplary characters in the Bible. When you study the life of Samuel, you just don't see much wrong. He was the last of the judges. He was also a priest for the people, and he was also a prophet of God. Really incredible guy. But he grew up in a time when Israel really didn't know God. They weren't really hearing from God. It's kind of a sad time in their history. It says in 1 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 1, "Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no frequent vision." It was, in fact, so rare for God to visit his people that Samuel goes to sleep in the temple one night. He sleeps near the Ark of the Covenant, which is kind of interesting because that's the symbolic presence of, you know, God in their midst. And that's where he chose to sleep. And he's in this room, and all of a sudden he hears his name called, Samuel. And he says, "Here I am." And then he goes to Eli's room and says, "Eli, did you call me? Because I heard my name." And Eli's like, "No, I didn't call you. Go to bed." So goes back, lays down again, and hears it again, Samuel. So he goes to Eli again. He's like, "You calling me? Because I heard it again." He's like, "No." So after three times, Eli starts to realize, "Oh, this might be God." So just next time, say, "You know, here I am. You know, your servant's ready to listen," kind of thing. And so he does that, and sure enough, it is God. But that's kind of the state of things in Israel right now. In fact, it says in verse 7, "Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, and the word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him." And this strikes me as really odd, because if you're being raised in the temple by a priest, I don't know, maybe God should be familiar to you, and maybe his word should be familiar to you just a little. And it's kind of like, what was Eli doing exactly? You know, what did his temple training consist of? Seems like that should be part of it. But then it kind of struck me that we have churches filled with people everywhere who call themselves the people of God, but they don't know God and they don't know his word. And it kind of broke my heart a little bit to think that, yeah, we're doing that too. We have an opportunity to know the living God and to hear from him and his word, and we just kind of ignore that. Well, Samuel grew up to be a pretty amazing man. It says in verses 19 and 20 that he grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. Isn't that a cool thing? Everything Samuel said, it says none of his words fell to the ground. It's like there was no useless stuff coming out of this guy's mouth. That could not be said about me. I think I have a lot of words that just, like, you know, tank right when they come out, it seems like. But really what this means is that Samuel was a prophet, and when he spoke something, you could count on it. And he became known throughout the land that Samuel was a prophet of God. So when Samuel hears his voice called and God comes to talk to him, unfortunately, this wasn't good news. He didn't come with a message of glad tidings. He came to basically tell Samuel this: "I am fed up with Eli and his sons." Eli was the priest, like I said, and his sons were also priests in the temple. And these were the kind of guys that used their position for gain. They would make sure that they got the fat portions of the meat that was being offered, you know, the ones they were supposed to wait and just put a stick, you know, a stick, it was like a prong in there, and whatever came out, that's what they got to eat. Well, they didn't do it that way. They made sure that, hey, that looks like the choice cut right there. It was like the guy, they would like went to the middle of the cinnamon roll and just pulled it out, you know. That was kind of what they were doing. I don't know why I thought of that, but it's the best part. Well, that was supposed to go to God, and they were making sure it came to them. And they were also mistreating the women, you know, that would come to the temple to worship God. And basically, these were, the Bible calls them worthless fellows. And I think that's going lightly, probably. And Eli, I don't think he was taking part in this, but he was sitting idly by and just doing nothing. So he knew what his boys were. He knew what they were doing, but he didn't really do anything about it. And so God says it's time to judge Eli and his sons. And shortly after that, he fulfills his promise. At this time, the Philistines were the chief enemy of Israel. They were their nemesis, so to speak. And in chapter 4, there's this battle that takes place where Israel gets their behinds handed to them, I think is the way you say it. They lost bad this day. And so they decide, well, we need to come up with a plan to win. And so they think they come up with this really good idea of how they're going to win the next battle. And what they do is they take the Ark of God, which again is the symbolic presence, you know, of God in his people's midst. They take it out of the temple and they march it out onto the battlefield. And they think that this is how it's going to work. You know, that we're going to take, I don't know what they were thinking was going to happen. If it was like going to be a scene out of Indiana Jones where all of a sudden this thing just opens up and takes, you know, the Philistines by storm or what. But what they were really doing is they were kind of strong-arming God, saying, we're going to put this out here and we expect something big from you. It's like you were trying to put God's arm behind his back and force him into doing what they wanted. And that's just always a bad idea. It's not the way things work. God doesn't have to do things for us. You know, he doesn't owe us that way. anything good he chooses to do is grace and mercy and love from him, and we should enjoy those things for sure. But we should never treat him like this genie in a bottle that, you know, we can just kind of make him do our, you know, dance for me. God, I want you to perform my will. And that's kind of what they did here. And it didn't go well. The plan backfired really badly. Israel lost over 30,000 men that day, including Eli's sons. And it says that when the news reached Eli, I'm just going to read it because it's kind of, Eli fell over backward from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for the man was old and heavy. So Eli heard the word, and he just, that was it. So God fulfilled the promise that he gave to Samuel that I'm done with Eli and his sons messing around, and he judged them that day as well. But to make matters even worse, the Philistines stole the Ark of the Covenant. So not only did they do this dumb thing by bringing it out there into the battlefield, but the Philistines said, well, we just beat you guys, and we're taking your ark, and we're going to go home. And they take it home, and they put it in the temple of their god, whose name was Dagon. And Dagon was a pretty awesome god that was half man and half fish, Dagon. So he's basically Aquaman is what they were worshiping, I think. Some people pronounce his name Dagon, which I think is where, I've read it, and I think that's where we get doggone it from. You might check me on that, but I think I'm going to go with Dagon, and I always say things wrong, so you guys will be okay. Now, the way that the Bible records this is just priceless, and I don't want to steal from it at all, so I'm just going to read it, because it's just proof that our God has an amazingly good sense of humor, I think. In chapter 5 and verse 1, it tells us what happened when they did this. When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon, and they set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod arose the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. I think that was pretty respectful of Dagon. He knew who the real God was, and he just bowed down before him. And then it says they took Dagon, they put him back in his place, but when they rose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. The head of Dagon and both of his hands were lying cut off at the threshold, and only the trunk was left to him. I don't care who you are, that's funny right there. Unless you're a worshiper of Dagon, then it's probably not very amusing, but I think it's funny. It goes on to say that they decided they better move him someplace else entirely before Dagon, just like the next morning it just would have been a pile of dust or something, you know. It's like, so they move him out of there, and they start kind of trying to find a place to put this thing. But no matter where they took it, the people became afflicted by plagues, and they were stricken. And I think the ESV politely says that they were stricken with tumors, but the good old King James says that they were, it says it this way, God smote them with hemorrhoids. I know. To me, it's just like, that is awesome. Because it's like, that's pretty good stuff. Now, one commentary explains that, that the pagan society would generally regard diseases that affected the private parts of the body as being judgment from the gods. Because, and it's, so this was, you know, God was, he was sending a message in what he did, but it's still funny. So they would have gotten this message loud and clear that the God of Israel was not happy with their decision to steal the ark from his people and from its rightful place. And they were more than happy to send it back, but this went on for 7 painful months, it says. That's a long time. 1 Samuel 5 and verse 11 says this. They sent therefore and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, send away the ark of the God of Israel and let it return to its own place that it may not kill us and our people. For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. So, without lifting a sword, the Ark of God found its way back to its rightful place. And I just think, I mean, our God is simply awesome, isn't he? There's none like him. Nobody had to go in and get it back. They didn't have to send a stealth guy in there and like sneak in and, you know, Mission Impossible, get the, you know, no. God just, they put it on a cow, and they just kind of like said, if the cow goes towards home, we know that that's where that's supposed to go. And the cow marched right back to Israel, where it belonged. They also sent little golden offerings, guilt offerings of little golden tumors and golden mice that were like supposed to relieve the guilt, which I thought was funny. It's like, what do we do with these? Just put them up on your mantle a little. Melt them down and make something cool out of them. I guess that's probably what they did. Anyway, it's about this point of the story that Israel as a people decide that they don't want to continue to let this God, this amazing God, be their king anymore. They want a man to be their king. And so they go to Samuel, and that's recorded for us in chapter 8, and it starts in verse 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the other nations." But this thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds they have done from the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice, only you should solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them." So it's difficult for me to understand why they thought this was a good solution. Why put a man in charge when you can have God in charge? Why? They had to have an angle they were trying to move here. And my guess is that, you know, in some twisted way, they believed that this would allow them to get what they wanted. They could do the things the other nations were doing. They could be like them. They could basically manipulate this guy and get what they wanted this way. And they couldn't do that with God. I'm not positive of their motive, but I'm sure about the message that they sent clearly to God. "God, we reject you as our king." That's really what they were saying loud and clear. And God answers back, "Okay, give the people what they want. That's what you want? Great, you can have it." But he also lets them know what they can expect. And I think that's pretty gracious of God, because a king, an earthly king, needs subjects, right? You can't be a king without people to do your bidding and take care of things. So you're going to need an army, and that's going to come from the sons and daughters of Israel. You're going to need people to make weapons. You're going to need somebody to feed all the troops and take care of your lawn and make sure that the place of the kingdom is nice in case you have guests. And you're going to need animals. You're going to need money to fund all this stuff. It's not going to be free, and it's going to come at the expense of the sons and daughters of Israel, like I said. But the people don't care. They don't care that they're going to get taxed. They don't care that their own children will be drafted into the king's service. And it's sad. In verse 18, it says, God warns them and says, "On that day," and this is the day when they realize what they've lost, "on that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you've chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, 'No, but there shall be a king over us, that we may be like all the other nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.'" What a slap in the face to God. It's like, we want a man who will judge us, who will govern us, and who will fight our battles for us. It's like, you want a man to do that when you could have God do that? Yeah. "And when Samuel heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, 'Obey their voice and make them a king.'" So they wanted a king, and a king they got. They became one nation under Saul, which Saul, on paper, looked really good. He was exactly what men want in a leader. He stood out among men. It said that he was a head taller than all the other men that were around, and he was really, really good looking, apparently. I don't know if he was really, really ridiculously good looking, but he was really good looking. So not only does he give him a king, but he gives him the type of king that they would have wanted. You know, when we go to pick somebody, we always try to pick that person that really stands out, and looks and, you know, stature and all these things kind of play into it usually. He might have looked good, but Saul had some major character flaws. He was really proud, he was dishonest, and he was unwilling to admit his mistakes. Have you ever been around somebody that was just unwilling to admit they were wrong? Even when it was like just really obvious that they were wrong? It's some of the most frustrating people to be around in the world. They just make excuses, they get defensive, and they start pointing fingers and they blame everything else, and it's never them. And it's like, it is you, you know, knock it off. But that's how Saul was. And ultimately, this is what would cost him his throne. There's two instances that basically we can read about in chapter 13 and 15 where this is clearly demonstrated. In the first example, and this is in chapter 13, Saul and his army were in a tight spot, and they had been instructed to wait for Samuel to get there, because Samuel was the priest, and the job of the priest was to make a burnt offering before the Lord before they would go into battle. And so he's supposed to be waiting for Samuel to show up to do this. But Saul got impatient, and he lost faith that Samuel was going to come. Things, you know, the circumstances started getting kind of weird, and so, you know, Saul decides, I got to take things into my own hands and do this myself. And it's just always a bad idea to do that, by the way. It always goes bad. Remember, Abraham did that once too. Don't do that. Wait for God. We read this in 1 Samuel 13, starting in verse 10. It says, as soon as he, Saul, had finished offering the burnt offerings. Again, Saul's not supposed to do the burnt offerings. That's the priest's job. As soon as he had finished the burnt offerings, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet and greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, well, when I saw the people that they were scattering from me and that you didn't come within the days appointed and the Philistines were, you know, beginning to muster the troops at Michmash, I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal. And I have not sought the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and I offered a burnt offering. Pretty good. So basically what he says is, you know, the people weren't, they were starting to scatter. You didn't show up when you said you were going to show up. I mean, if you would have been here, I wouldn't have had to do this, but somebody needed to seek the favor of the Lord here and you weren't here to do it. So I forced myself to just, you know, go ahead and do your job. See how he does that, justifying his behavior and blame shifting and all these kinds of things. In verse 13, Samuel says to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord with which he commanded you, for then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people because you have not kept what the Lord has commanded you. In the second example, and that's in chapter 15, this is a place where God gives Saul, through Samuel, really clear instructions on what to do with this group of people called the Amalekites. And again, the Amalekites were just a nasty group of people who were doing a lot of evil things before God. And it was one of these times where God just said, I want them to be completely and utterly judged. So go in there and wipe out everything. And there's just these occasions where God does this, and it's his divine justice. We've talked about that in past sermons. I'm not going to get into that now. But this is one of those times when he told Saul, everything gets wiped out, even the animals. He wants no trace of them left. And so what we read in verse 9 of chapter 15 is this. But Saul and the people spared Agag, who is the king, and the best of the sheep, and of the oxen, and of the fattened calves, and the lambs, and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them. All that was despised and worthless, they devoted to destruction. So if it was good, they were like, put that in that pile over there, we're keeping that stuff. If it was bad, they're like, yeah, we can devote that to destruction, that's cool. God's not happy with that. So we read in verse 12, Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning. And Samuel came to Saul and said, blessed be you to the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. That's Saul's first statement. I've done what I was supposed to do. And Samuel said, why do I hear sheep in the background? And how come I can hear ox making noises back there if you've done what you're supposed to do? And Saul in verse 15 says, they brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God. That's why they're here. We devoted the rest of the stuff to destruction, but this is the good stuff, and we want to sacrifice to God with it. So see again what he does there. Another kind of spin. I mean, he was a typical politician. Not going there, just saying. Then Samuel said to Saul, stop. I will tell you what the Lord said to me this night. And he said to him, speak. And Samuel said, though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go devote to destruction the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord? And listen to Saul's response. And Saul said to Samuel, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on the mission that the Lord sent me. I have brought back Agag, the king, and I have devoted the Amalekites to destruction. But the people took the spoil, the sheep and the oxen, the best things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. So again, he just will not admit that he's wrong, and he's caught red-handed. I mean, the guy just blew it. He's the king. He's the one that makes the call. And now he's saying, oh, it was the people. You know, I brought the king back, but the people did the rest of this stuff. Well, it was all wrong. This kind of attitude, it's sinful, ugly pride that God detests. The Bible makes it clear that God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And in a couple of chapters, we're going to be introduced to a different kind of king, a king that God will raise up. He's a man who also screws up, but he's willing to humbly admit it. And he feels bad about it when God reveals it to him. And he wants to turn from it when it happens. And you know what God calls a man like that? He calls him a man after his own heart. And I like that. because I want to be a man after God's own heart. And I screw up a lot too. And that just gives me hope. When you screw up, admit it before God. Confess your sin. Agree with God that it's wrong. And then allow Him to just transform you and make you different. So Saul keeps trying to impress Samuel by even after he's been clearly disobedient, by saying that they were going to offer sacrifices, and that's supposed to make it okay. You know, yeah, we may not have done exactly what God said, but we're going to offer sacrifices, so this is really should just work out fine. And in verse 22, Samuel reveals God's heart about this to him, and he says, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices more than in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams." So he's just saying, like, God does like our offerings. He really likes offerings. But you know what He likes even better? He likes it when you listen and do what He says. And as a parent, I can respect that. I can remember, hey, my kid, hey, I'm not going to mention names, but it's one of the five. I remember times when Joy would tell the kids very clearly, "I want you to clean your room. Clean your room." Very simple instruction. Clean the room. And she would go to check on the room, and guess what? Not clean. And then she would say, "Why didn't you clean the room?" And they would say, "Oh, I didn't do that, but you know what I did do?" And they would list off, "But I took the garbage out," or I pet the dog, or I mean, it was always, they had something that they did. And it was like, look at this sacrifice. Look at this offering I'm willing to give you. But you know what we really wanted? We just wanted the room clean. We wanted to listen to what we said, and we wanted to actually do it. And that's what God wants. We do this all the time, even as God's people still. I can't tell you how many times I hear this thing where God has made it clear how He wants His people to live. He's told us, "I want you to live this way." But we don't want to live that way. So we'll find a cute sacrifice of some kind, something that we can offer Him and say, "Look, I didn't do what you said, but look at that." You know, like He's going to be really happy about that. He's not. He's not. He's told you, oh man, how to live. Walk humbly before your God and do what He's asked you to do. That makes Him happy. So, to obey is better than sacrifice. Remember that one. God lets Saul know exactly how he feels about his awesome sacrifice in verse 23. "Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, He has also rejected you from being king." Done. And as Samuel turns to go away, it says in verse 27, Saul seized the skirt of his robe and it tore. And Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you." So God gave the people the king they wanted, and it didn't work out too well. So now it's God's turn to pick a king. And we read about that in 1 Samuel 16. God tells Samuel to go to Bethlehem to a house of a man named Jesse. And he says, "Of Jesse's sons, you'll find the next king." And so Samuel goes there and he's meeting Jesse's sons. And the first one that he notices is one named Eliab. And he was really impressed with this guy. He saw Eliab and he's like, "This is the guy. It's got to be the guy." You know, he just looked at him and thought, "Yep, surely the Lord's anointed is before me right now." And God said, "Nope, that's not him." And he says in verse 7 this. God gives us His criteria for what He's looking for. "Do not look on His appearance or on the height of His stature, because I have rejected Him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." That's good news for most of us. Because when it comes right down to it, we're not a real impressive bunch, you know? And yet God looks at our heart, and He will use the heart of a man or woman that is for Him. Jesse passes all 7 of his sons before Samuel, and God's response was the same. "Not that one either. Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Nope, not him. And they run out of sons. So all the sons have passed by, and Samuel goes, "Okay, Lord, do you have another son of some kind that somebody else in the family we don't know about?" And he's like, "Oh, yeah, we got one guy, but he's tending the sheep. We didn't even consider him. I mean, you don't want to see this dude. That's the one. That's the guy we want to see." So Samuel said, "We'll stand here and wait till you bring him back." And here comes David. The runt, I guess, of the litter, right? I mean, they weren't even considering. You can't be serious about wanting David, can you? Yeah, that's who I want. Man's criteria has a lot to do with the outward stuff, but God looked at David and He saw a humble man, a tender man, a man who worships God. David was concerned about God's name and His fame and His glory in a way that I love. And it's probably comes out better in one story than most others. And that's a story that you're probably familiar with, but it's David and Goliath. So David would have been nobody's pick, you know, either here or in this next story we're going to read, but he was God's front runner. And I like that. Now, he didn't instantly become king that day because Saul had started his rise to kingship and he was starting to go this way. And David was kind of just starting his rise too, but they were going to be kind of together for a while before David was actually made king. But God had picked him at this point. So David and Goliath is probably a story you guys know. And I love this story. And I don't mind if you've never heard it. You're in for something good. If you have, you're in for something good. So the people of Israel were once again at war with the Philistines, their nemesis. That was like the, you know, Newman. They didn't like these guys. They hated each other. One Seinfeld fan out there, let's go. Hello, Philistines. That's what it was like. And hello, Israel. It was that type of thing. The Philistines had a champion whose name was Goliath, and this dude was awesome. We read about him in chapter 17, starting in verse 4. There came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the spearhead weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. Now, most of you guys don't know cubits and shekels, so I'll help you out here a little bit. 6 cubits and a span. There's different opinions about this, but basically this dude was like 9.5 feet tall. And some of you might, and he probably, the armor stuff that he's wearing, something like 150 pounds. And I remember going backpacking once, and I had a 50-pound pack. I thought I was going to die. So 150 pounds of armor. I don't know what a weaver's beam is, but this guy, he was a specimen, I think. Some people, you know, they hear this height, and they think, oh, guys, this is just another tall tale in the Bible. See that? Tall tale. You like that? Yeah, I know. Sorry. But the truth is that these kinds of guys have been recorded throughout history all the time. Even in our own day, the Guinness Book, you'll find guys over 8 feet tall. Pliny, who lived a long time ago, I don't know if it was Pliny the Elder or Pliny the Younger, but he was a secular historian, and he wrote, the tallest man that had been seen in our day was named Gabara, who in the days of Claudius, the late emperor, was brought out of Arabia. He was 9 feet 9 inches. And Josephus mentions a Jew, again, a secular historian, named Eleazar, who was 7 cubits, or 10 feet 2 inches high. So they found bones. There are people that are this tall. You know, it's not a tall tale, so to speak. So the point is clear, though, in all of this. Nobody wanted to mess with this guy. He stood, in verse 8, it says, he stood and he shouted to the ranks of Israel, why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are not you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves. Let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, you shall be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. And I'm pretty sure I would have been kind of tucked behind Saul, you know, like, oh man, who's going out there? If you've ever been around somebody that's really tall, they're just intimidating, kind of. You know, they just kind of like, yeah, you feel small around them. And this guy wasn't just tall. He was like, you know, really strong and apparently really good at hand-to-hand combat and real confident, you know, in his abilities. This guy he didn't have any self-esteem issues, I don't think. So I can see why nobody wanted to take this guy up on his offer. But then along comes the runt, David. His dad basically says, hey, take some lunch to your brothers. They're fighting today. Go feed them. Go give them some food and make sure that they're strengthened for the battle. And so David, you know, it's like he jumps on his bike and runs down and brings his brothers lunch for the battle, you know. And he gets there and he sees what's going on. And he can't believe his eyes. I mean, here's a young boy, basically, David. It doesn't say how old he was, but he was young. And then that'll be clear when you start to see Goliath's response here in a minute. This is what he says. I don't have the verse written down, but he says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? That was David's question when he walked in. And he tells Saul, hey, I'll go fight him. And everybody's like thinking, oh, man. And Saul says it, actually, in verse 33. Saul says to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine. I mean, you're but a youth. And this guy's been a fighter. He's been a warrior since his youth. You can't do this. But David's confident in the Lord. And he says this in verse 36. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them. He has defied the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, God be with you. You know, it's like, all right, go give it a shot, young guy. You know, and they dress them all up in the armor that they're supposed to wear when they go out in these things. And it's kind of, you know, that chainmail stuff, and I've never been in it, but it doesn't sound very comfortable. And David's not used to this. I mean, he can't move in it. He goes, I haven't tested this stuff out. I'm just going to go do it my way if it's okay with you. So he just heads out there like this. It basically takes verse 40. Then he took his staff in his hand, and he chose 5 smooth stones from the brook, and he put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. That's what he went out with, a stick, a sling, and some rocks. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. Now, I can't imagine what I would be doing at this point, but it wouldn't be moving forward towards Goliath. It just, I'd rethink this quickly, but I just love David in this. He's just so confident in God. And this is what he says in verse 45 to the Philistine. You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the army of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand. I will strike you down and cut off your head, and I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, and all the earth will know that there is a God in Israel. And that this assembly shall know that the Lord saves not with sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. That's awesome. I don't know if Goliath was scared at this point or not, but he should have been. It says, when the Philistine arose and came near, or drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag, and he took a stone, and he slung it, and he struck the Philistine in the forehead, and the stone sank in his forehead, and he fell to the ground. That's cool. And I don't know if you've ever seen one of these things. I got to get on YouTube, and I had to look, because I was curious. People still do this today. They will get, it's like a rope sling. You put a rock in this thing, and you just kind of give it a couple of, and sling this thing, and it's like a bullet coming out. And these guys are accurate. They can hit what they're aiming for. So this is a real deal. He just took this thing, and I mean, I can't imagine what that would have been like. He just runs out. I mean, then just imagine the sound of this dude hitting the ground. The ground must have shook as this guy just went, you know. It would have been just amazing to watch. And I can imagine at the same time that that thing happened, that the hearts of the Philistines did the same thing. Just like, oh, man. It's like a kid just took out our champion. It's good stuff. Verse 50. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. And David did exactly what he said. He ran over and he took the head of the Philistine. And when the Philistines saw it, they fled, which is probably smart. Needless to say, David's popularity grew that day pretty immensely, and it started this jealous kind of hatred that Saul started to have towards David as he watched his own star kind of diminish and David's star rise, and the people didn't help much. There's in chapter 18, verse 6, as they were coming home after this triumphal thing, you know, they like do a parade and all the people come out and they're all singing and excited, and it says, as they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines and songs of joy and musical instruments. And I imagine Saul was like just so proud and thinking, look at what we did. And the women are singing. And this is what their song goes like. It's got great lyrics. It says this, Saul has struck down his thousands. Hey, Saul. And David, 10,000s. And Saul didn't like that song much. It's like, what was that last part again? Yeah. Yeah, and basically it says in verse 9 that from that point forward, Saul eyed David. And that's really, you know, there's obviously a lot more to this story, and I'm not going to keep going because we're at time, but read 1 and 2 Samuel. I have no idea where Jordan's picking up from this, but Saul would basically go on trying to chase David down for years, losing his mind over this whole thing. And he would chase him all over the countryside trying to kill him. And David would be on the run. And during this time, he writes some of the most amazing psalms that we have. You know, when you read the psalms and you're wondering what's going on, this is what's going on. King Saul is trying to take this guy out. And he's writing these songs to God. And some of them are like, oh, you know, God, where'd you go? You know, why aren't you helping me here? And some of them are like, you know, just faith and trust and praising God. So this was a really rich time in David's life where he was learning a lot. Eventually, Saul would get injured in battle and he would end up falling on his own sword. It's kind of ironic to me to think that Israel's first king took his own life, but Israel's final king would give his own life. It's pretty neat to think about. Eventually, David would become the king of Israel, and they would go from being separate tribes ruled by judges to one unified kingdom under one king. So the people wanted a king, and God gave them two very different versions of a king in Saul and David. I believe that God wanted to teach his people something through this, though, that they would understand that even the greatest of king really isn't what we're looking for when it comes to a man king. And even though David was a man after God's own heart, at the end of the day, they were still wanting something. And it's kind of like what Jordan talked about last time, you know, when you're watching a TV show and it gets to the end and there's that cliffhanger and you want to see what's coming next. And that's how they must have felt. Well, that king was kind of good, but there's got to be more. And there is more. There is a king that King David wrote about that would come in Psalm 145:13. He talked about somebody whose kingdom would be an everlasting kingdom and his dominion would endure through all generations. And this king would come from the line of David also. But he would come into the world with very little fanfare. You know, when I think about if I was going to come on the scene as a king, if I'm God Almighty and I'm going to show up as a king, it's going to be impressive. It's going to be awesome for you to see. And that's not how our king chose to show up. You know what your king is like? He could have made any entrance he wanted to. And you know how he came? A humble baby in a stable. He was born in a feed trough in the middle of nowhere. No fanfare. You would think that he could have made himself look any way he wanted to. But you know what Isaiah says he looks like? Isaiah 53, written some 800 or 900 years before Jesus ever came, he said this. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before his shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. That is your king. That is your king. He came the first time as a lamb to lay his life down for sinners. But make no mistake about it, when he comes the second time, he comes as a lion. He comes as a warrior, ready to do business. Every knee will bow to this king. Every tongue will confess that he is Lord. Are you part of his kingdom? Are you one of his subjects? Because you can be today and you want to be on his side. If Goliath brought fear, this is nothing compared to Goliath. Jesus Christ is amazing. We remember what he's done by taking communion when we come here at church for a reason. We didn't deserve this. We didn't deserve for him to come. We didn't deserve for him to be our king, and yet he wanted to. He chose to out of love. He went to a cross willingly and laid down his life. And that's what communion does, is it just simply remembers what he's done for us. He allowed his body to be broken, and he allowed his blood to be shed. This table is set for believers. It's a way for us to remember what he's done and to thank him for it and to worship. My prayer is that each of you would be a man after his own heart, that you would humble yourself today and consider who this God is and what he's done for you. Father, thank you so much for stories like these in the Old Testament that we can learn from, that we can just be in awe of who you are. You're glorious, Lord. You're amazing. You're like no one else. And we thank you so much that you chose to send us your Son, our King. And Lord, I know we're still anticipating the finality of his kingdom where he will truly come and reign, but it's as good as done because of the cross. And we thank you for his willingness to go there and trade places with us. We should have been the one nailed to that cross. We should have been the one. We were the guilty ones. He was not the guilty one. He was innocent. And yet he allowed himself to be placed there for the sins of men so that we could have forgiveness and have life with you. So thank you for pursuing people like us, for giving us a chance to have a real relationship with you. Thank you for opening your kingdom to sinners and for allowing us to just to take part in this table now. In Jesus' name.
Amen.